Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
When did religion, cognition, and culture emerge? Armin W. Goetz. Let me take you back some 3 million years to an area located in South Africa. A group of creatures known today as the extinct Australopithecus africanus, meaning southern ape of Africa, were foraging near a lazy stream. Archaeologists who discovered their remains in the 1920s considered them to be the missing link between apes and humans. These gracile hominid creatures could walk bipedally, but probably moved mostly on all fours while foraging. They were still able to climb trees and may have slept in them, but they spent a good deal of time erect on two legs while feeding. They ate the same foods as baboons: fruit flowers, seeds, pods, leaves, tubers and bulbs, now and then supplemented by bone marrow, meat and shellfish, and their brains were the size of the great apes, 400 cubic centimetres. This group was searching for food near the stream, some of them quenching their thirst along the way. Suddenly, one of the horde caught a glimpse of a red stone in the water. She picked it up. The nearly round and smooth stone fitted nicely in her hand. Looking more closely, she noticed markings on it. She excitedly called the others. They crowded around and looked wonderingly at the stone. The stone had markings on both sides. On the one side, they saw a strange and disturbing face with deep eyes and an open mouth. On the other side, they saw markings that looked like their own faces. They felt the stone was so important that they carried it some 30 kilometres to a cave overlooking a beautiful valley, known today as the Makapan Valley. 3 million years later, the stone, or cobble, as it is properly called, was found by archaeologists in 1925, together with Australopithecine remains. The significance of the stone was not realised until much later, not until the 1970s. What has now become known as the Makapanskat cobble is a brownish-red jasperite stone, 83.3 millimetres long, 69.5 millimetres wide, 38.4 millimetres thick, and weighing 260 grams. The jasperite is crisscrossed by greyish-green quartz veins. Archaeologist Robert G. Bednarik, who performed a scientific analysis of the cobble, published in 1998, concluded that the markings on the stone were not man-made. Rather, they were the result of natural impact damage and worn smooth by water. Its most significant features are the markings which resemble a human face on one side and an Australopithecine face on the other. Since the stone was not used as a tool, it must have been transported because of its iconographic features. The cobble is the oldest example of what is known today as a manuport, a natural object that was moved by a human agent, in this case, a hominid agent. Why is it important to dwell on an object that looks man-made but isn't? The answer to that question lies in recent debates on the cognitive abilities of non-humans. The question has often been framed in terms of human exceptionalism. By that I mean the search, often for religious or ideological reasons, for what is unique about humans. The history of exceptionalism has resulted in a rollercoaster science of discoveries. someone decides that only humans have this or that trait, such as hunting, morality, language, war, and so on, followed by a wave of publications proving that other animals have these traits too. Archaeologist Robert Foley called it the evolutionary catch-22 in his book Humans Before Humanity, 1995. He thinks that the roots of our exceptionalism may very well be that the many species before us, and even some who were contemporaneous with the first Homo sapiens, are now extinct. So we have no examples of proto-humans living in isolated jungles or deserts or caves so that we can study them. Nor do we have examples of proto-language in natural settings. It is therefore not so strange that we think we are so special. In discussions on cognition, most cognitive scientists and evolutionary psychologists argue that symbolic thought could only have originated with language, and that the first examples of symbolic thought are found in the spectacular cave paintings in Europe dated around 30,000 years ago. These paintings represent what is called the symbolic explosion, but which, if you think about it, is a disturbing claim in evolutionary terms. Why should symbolic thought only have arisen in that particular area of the world at that particular time, out of nowhere? And how could language arise without symbolic thought? Surely that is putting the wagon before the horse. Some evolutionary biologists and psychologists have rejected the idea that only Homo sapiens had symbolic competence. Biologist Terence Deacon argues in his book, The Symbolic Species, 1997, that what distinguishes us from other creatures is our symbolic competence. Symbolic competence means that we can think and communicate by referring to virtual worlds and meanings far from real environmental settings. All animals can communicate, but their communication is limited to sounds linked to particular things or events in the environment. To use semiotic terms, they communicate indexically and iconically. Humans can communicate about things that have nothing to do with the environment. In other words, symbolically. Language is the penultimate example of a symbolic system, where meanings only make sense within the linguistic system itself. Psychologist Merlin Donald has eloquently argued in his book Origins of the Modern Mind, 1991, that language came after symbolic thought and not before. Furthermore, he argued that symbolic communication must have been possible for the entire 2 million years of the hominin line. As soon as our brains evolved to allow us to gain executive control over our bodies, mimetic communication arose. Mimetic communication was a first step in the long evolution of symbolic communication. We still use mimesis today in our everyday communication. Some have even made an art of it. Think of the talented pantomimes of Marcel Marceau, or the antics of silent movie comedians such as Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. They told stories that were complex and emotionally stimulating. They told these stories through the controlled use of body movements, termed mimodramas. Marceau called his work L'art du silence. Now, when did symbolic competence appear, or rather, how did it appear in an environment without symbolic thought? It must have been gradual. There must have been antecedents to the increased abilities of the hominin line. Surely the creatures before the hominin line must have shown some kind of symbolic abilities. But alas, the evidence is missing, except, of course, for the isolated example of the Makapansgat kobol. Although the Makapansgat group could still climb trees, they were bipedal. This allowed them to carry things, dig for roots and tubers, and throw stones and other projectiles. Something was changing with the Australopithecine line. Besides an erect posture, their teeth were changing, and they also shared food. Their social organization may have been a harem-like system with a strong male and a number of females, so they had not yet developed nuclear families. As far as archaeologists can tell, although this is disputed, They did not manufacture tools, even though they may have used bones as tools and weapons. Their cognitive capacities were most likely ape-like. But why would the Australopithecines pick up an iconographic stone and carry it 30 kilometres? Robert Bednarik is in no doubt. If the Australopithecines did not have some kind of symbolic sense, we would be obliged to come up with another explanation. But in Darwinian terms, the most parsimonious conclusion would be that they recognized the object as being special. They would not have recognized the one side as human, since there were no humans around at the time. They would most likely have found that face uncanny and troubling. The other side, however, looks like their own faces. As Bednarik asked in a 1998 paper for the South African Archaeological Bulletin, if they were not curious, inquisitive creatures with a penchant for cognitive stimulation, how could they possibly have developed the behaviour patterns that led to those facilitating human evolution? It is, in my view, essential to expect Australopithecine behaviour to be significantly more complex in a cultural and cognitive sense than that of any extant non-human primate. In order to understand cognition, we must first ask, when did cognition arise in animals? The answer, it seems, is a long time ago. Until about 540 million years ago, all animals were, as cognitive scientist Michael Trestman puts it, small, slow, squishy, and stupid, in that they lacked brains. They were floating in the primordial sea with filter feeders to catch food. But then, with the Cambrian epoch, called the Cambrian Explosion, although we are talking about their appearance over tens of millions of years, an astounding array of complex animals arose which became the ancestors of all known phyla that have existed since. The creatures that appeared in the Cambrian had rigid skeletal structures, jointed appendages, eyes, and brains. Trestman argues that these new bodies were driven by a cognitive toolkit, which he calls basic cognitive embodiment. Such a toolkit, he says, is necessary in order to control large moving bodies in space filled with other large moving bodies, most of whom are on the lookout for some other bodies to eat. These bodies could move quickly and manipulate objects. They saw things in space, used the information coming to their senses in order intelligently to control their bodies and move them accordingly. These were the first predators. The changes that took place were not just physiological, they were also cognitive. The basic cognitive toolkit for dealing with the new environment was 1. Spatial, 2. Object-oriented, and 3. Agent or action-oriented. This cognitive suite gave the three phyla that have it, vertebrates, arthropods, and cephalopods, enormous selective advantages over the other 30 or so phyla. So we share these basic cognitive properties with other animals, especially the vertebrates, a fact that has been demonstrated time and again in cognitive experiments with humans and animals. But what is human cognition like? Surely we are more than intelligent brains moving complexly articulated bodies with eyes. Well, yes. More or less. And not unlike a lot of other animals, we have taken over our own evolution, creating niches for ourselves and other interesting things. Our particular niche is culture. Thus, what is characteristic of human cognition is not what many cognitivists claim as consisting of representations of space, objects and agents, memory, and so on. We share these abilities with most other animals. What is particularly characteristic of human cognition is that it is embodied and embrained, situated, distributed, extended, materialized, and deeply cultural. Each aspect is currently under debate by psychologists, philosophers, neuroscientists, archaeologists, anthropologists, and other cultural and social scientists. so I will need to simplify. By embodied and embrained, I mean that our cognition is fundamentally tied to our bodies and brains. In other words, our biological contexts determine how we are capable of cognizing anything at all. As I will mention below, our brains are predictive organs, always filling in the blanks left by our senses, memories, and experiences, and always trying to work out what is going to happen next. A very important research area concerns our emotions. We are much more emotional than the rational creatures we think, in our vanity, that we are. Furthermore, a lot of new research is showing us how incredibly sensitive our nervous system is to our mental and emotional states, and how easy it is for us to manipulate and influence our bodily, mental, and emotional states, and, more importantly, those of others. Our cognition is situated in particular contexts. Those contexts are in natural and constructed environments, but more importantly, in social environments. Social environments allow us to learn from others, but also to maneuver and avoid others, such as enemies and weirdos, or to connect with others, such as families, friends, and significant others. Our cognition is very much distributed. It consists of a gigantic web of information, contacts, feelings, values, and so on. Today, our web is worldwide, and we participate in it, and it participates in and through us, for better or for worse. In a sense, our cognition is extended. We cannot help ourselves. We simply pour out our cognitive and emotional states into the world around us. We try to narrate ourselves to the world, but even when we try to control or hide our mental and emotional states, our bodies tattle on us. Other people can read us like a book, because our bodies are constantly sending out signals about ourselves, our gender, our background emotional states, our intentions, and our recent and past histories. The last two aspects, materialized and deeply cultural, will bring us back to the point of this paper. Our cognition is materialized in the sense that it is both materially manifested, for instance, in architecture, design, clothes, and weapons, as well as materially grounded. By the latter, I mean that material objects help us think. They are key factors in the cognitive and motor development of babies, and they rewire our brains. Not only material culture constrains our cognition, the immaterial aspects of culture, values, norms, traditions, ideas, tastes, worldviews, and spiritual aspirations are, if anything, even more important. When humans get together, they do so culturally. Social situations, individual roles, personal identities, and group behavior are informed by cultural assumptions. As anthropologist Clifford Geertz once remarked, our cultural values shape what we consider to be the really real. We have trouble conceiving of the world in any other way. The origins of culture are much debated, but if we use the presence of tools, and especially of tool-making, as an indication of the presence of culture, and here I am not just referring to material culture, then we surprisingly find that culture seems more or less to have arisen with the hominin line going back to around 2.5 million years ago. In other words, culture arose more than 2 million years before Homo sapiens appeared on Earth. This should give us pause for thought. Many evolutionary psychologists, cognitive scientists, and alas, cognitive scientists of religion believe that culture has no causal influence on human cognition. And yet we know that the hominin line is more or less defined by the deep immersion in and development of the deliberate use of culture, and perhaps more excitingly, that culture seems to have driven the expansion of the brain witnessed in the hominin line. The hominin line had a number of creatures with exotic names like Homo habilis, age 1.8 million years ago, brain size 641 cubic centimeters, Homo ergaster, age 1.9 million years ago, brain size 848 cubic centimetres. Homo erectus, age 1.7 million years ago, brain size 986 to 1149 cubic centimetres, and so on. The distinguishing characteristic of these creatures is the gradual expansion of the brain. When Homo sapiens emerged sometime between 200,000 and 150,000 years ago, the brain had evolved to 1,250 cubic centimetres. The expansion was not simply one of size. The brain expanded in particular ways. The cortex, especially the prefrontal areas, expanded. This means that the so-called executive function areas expanded, thus allowing sustained attention, multi-level planning, a sense of self, social intelligence, and so on. In his book, A Brief History of the Mind, From Apes to Intellect and Beyond, 2004, neurobiologist William H. Calvin notes that there were two major brain booms. The first took place around 2.5 million years ago, when the Ice Age began in France, which led to the drying of the habitat in Africa, with a subsequent reduction in forests, up to 80%, and an increase in savanna lands. Diet became less vegetarian, and the hominids and first hominins had to leave the forests and forage at the borderlines between woodlands and savanna. The hominins started making tools, and the brain expanded. Calvin argues that the increase in brain size followed the increase in body size, probably due to the growth in meat consumption, but they had already begun to change the social systems with improved cooperation and sharing. The next brain boom happened about 750,000 years ago, which more or less coincided with the melting of the ice and the reversal of the Earth's magnetic poles. The need for better hunting techniques evidently played a role, which could have been decisive for the expansion of the brain. The creatures at this stage were Homo erectus. They had appeared about 1.7 million years ago. The evidence is clear that they were predominantly meat-eating beings. They were able to make weapons and throw them accurately at prey. This may not sound like much, but try it yourself. Try throwing a rock, for instance, at a bird or a squirrel, and see what happens. It requires attention, careful calculation, planning, and the skillful use of 100 muscles. Doing it well uses much of the brain, especially the association areas, which again could have led to greater neurological flexibility. This flexibility could, in turn, have led to a kind of proto-language. Two-word sentences would definitely have provided a significant advantage over animal calls that were often restricted to one meaning. There was an increase in attentional abilities, the ability to plan and to coordinate communal intentions and goals. Big game hunting requires not only cooperation, but also reciprocal sharing, where payoffs could extend over long periods. Sexual dimorphism, the difference in size between males and females, was closer to the differences we have today, small, in sharp contrast to the other animals, indicating a social change towards a nuclear family structure. Homo erectus used fire, made shelters, had seasonal base camps, and they left Africa, spreading all the way to Asia. They survived in Asia until 50,000 years ago, the longest living hominin. How did this happen? Why did the brain expand? The answer seems to lie in the development of tools and the domestication of fire, with subsequent food preparation. Let's first look briefly at tools. Even though the Australopithecines may have used very primitive tools, our Macapan group might have, the deliberate production of tools was more developed among the hominins. The first kind of tool was the so-called older one, named after the old device site in Tanzania, or pebble tool. These consisted of simple flakes, struck off the pebbles, and choppers. The older one lasted for more than 1 million years without any changes. The next type, which was introduced by Homo erectus, was the so-called Acheulean or biface tool. These were cores shaped on both sides and used as hand axes, and were qualitatively different to the older one. This style also lasted about 1 million years. The argument runs that the conservatism of tool types across continents must be an indication of limited cognitive ability, at least in relation to the much later, wider variety and creativity of Homo sapiens tools, even within the same campsites. Nevertheless, tool making had a major impact on the brain and most likely drove its expansion. Anthropologist Clifford Geertz was already onto the implications of tool use when he wrote in his 1962 essay, The Growth of Culture and the Evolution of Mind. Most crucially, it then becomes apparent that not only was cultural accumulation underway well before organic development ceased, but that such accumulation very likely played an active role in shaping the final stages of that development. Though it is apparently true enough that the invention of the airplane led to no visible bodily changes, no alterations of innate mental capacity, this was not necessarily the case for the pebble tool or the crude chopper, in whose wake seems to have come not only more erect stature, reduced dentition, and a more thumb-dominated hand, but the expansion of the human brain to its present size. Because tool manufacture puts a premium on manual skill and foresight, its introduction must have acted to shift selection pressures so as to favor the rapid growth of the forebrain, as, in all likelihood, did the advances in social organization, communication, and moral regulation, which there is reason to believe also occurred during this period of overlap between cultural and biological change. Nor were such nervous system changes merely quantitative. Alterations in the interconnections among neurons and their manner of functioning may have been of greater importance than the simple increase in their number. Details aside, however, and the bulk of them remain to be determined, the point is that the innate, generic constitution of modern man, what used in a simpler day to be called human nature, now appears to be both a cultural and a biological product. Cognitive archaeologist Lambros Malaforis argues that at the brain-artifact interface, artifacts change the functional structure and anatomy of the human brain. Psychologist Margaret Wilson argues that culture in general re-engineers cognition during child development. Tools of all sorts alter the how of cognition. She calls it cognitive retooling. Although Wilson was not simply referring to physical tools, they nonetheless have a decided impact on the developing infant brain. Tool making itself is an incredibly complicated process. In her book, How to Think Tools, A Comparison of Cognitive Aspects in Tool Behavior of Animals and During Human Evolution, 2012, archaeologist Miriam Noel-Heidler compares the cognitive abilities of tool-using animals. She does this by numbering the planning, execution, and use of tools into what she calls cognigrams. These are the smallest units of cognitive and/or physical actions. When a chimpanzee uses a rock to crush nuts or a sharp stick to spear a monkey, he uses about the same number of cognigrams as a Homo habilis using an Alderwan tool to cut meat, more or less 15 units. The difference between the chimp and the hominin, however, is that the latter actually produced the tool by using another tool. This is a qualitative leap. By the time we find the production of a wooden spear by Homo heidelbergensis, 1.3 million to 200,000 years ago, using Acheulean technology, to hunt horses at Schöningen, Lower Saxony, the number of cognigrams has grown to 29, with about as many subunits. Furthermore, we need to consider the domestication of fire. It seems that the Australopithecines had used fire, but evidence of controlled fire use dates to about 400,000 years ago, most likely by Homo erectus. There is growing evidence that suggests that Homo erectus habitually used fire as early as 1 million years ago in South Africa. Biologist Richard Wrangham, in his book Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human, 2009, introduced the cooking hypothesis, where he argues that Homo erectus gained significant advantages through the use of cooking, which again led to changes in physiology, ecology, psychology, and society. Anthropologist Frances Burton, in her book Fire, The Spark That Ignited Human Evolution, 2009, argues further that the use of fire is what started the hominin line in the first place, because the use of firelight at night brought significant changes in brain structure and the hormonal system. Both of these hypotheses rest on the assumption that the hominin line introduced innovations that changed the effects of the environment on themselves. In a very real sense, then, tool use and fire control allowed the hominin line to domesticate itself. Merlin Donald nicely sums it up in Origins of the Modern Mind, 1991. The main impression Erectus leaves is one of a systematic, organized creature who was able to hunt and manufacture tools cooperatively, cook food, transmit skills across generations, and grow culturally, albeit at a snail's pace compared with modern humans. I have argued in my chapter, Whence Religion, in A.W. Gertz, ed., Origins of Religion, Cognition and Culture, 2013, that in our search for the origins of religious behaviour or proto-religious behaviour, Homo erectus and or Homo ergaster or Homo heidelbergensis, depending on the classification system used, is a fairly good candidate. Religious-like behaviour may have occurred 600,000 years ago in South Africa and Ethiopia, where we find evidence of post-mortem manipulation. A shaft in Cima de los Huesos, Atapuerca, Spain, containing the skeletons of 32 hominins and dated 200,000 to 320,000 years ago, has been interpreted as a deliberate burial. Symbolic behaviour is evidenced by the existence of two proto-figurines. The figurine found in Tantan, Morocco, dated between 300,000 and 500,000 years ago, and the so-called Venus of Berichot Ram, found in the Golan Heights, and dated between 233,000 and 470,000 years ago. These figurines are natural stone objects with anthropomorphic features, but also with hominin-made grooves and traces of ochre. Before I describe what I think the proto-religious behaviour of Homo erectus around the time of, say, 300,000 years ago was like, let us briefly reflect on the kinds of brains and minds that we are looking for. I argue that the fundamental features of human beings are 1. A finely honed social cognition. 2. A drive to communicate and cooperate. 3. A self-deceptive brain. And 4. A superstitious brain prone to unusual mental and/or emotional experiences. My list is based on recent neuroscientific and psychological insights. Our social intelligence and behaviour is ready at birth, and probably before. We send signals and receive signals that communicate feelings, mental states, intentions and predictions about each other. We attempt to influence and manipulate each other in order to attain our goals. From the most innocent cries and gurgles of the newborn baby to the thunderous rhetoric and gurgles of the populist politician, and all the shades of communication in between. We have a highly developed mind-reading ability where we can discern each other's mental and emotional states and goals, as well as figure out the limits of each other's knowledge, a very useful social ability. Because of our ancient heritage, we need to communicate and cooperate. Loners don't survive for long, despite what Hollywood Westerns tell us. What most people, including cultural analysts, do not know is that neurologists have discovered that the brain is a prediction machine. It fills in all the gaps in the world of the senses, of which there are many. Sometimes the gaps are so big that we lose touch with reality and end up getting lost in our own mental worlds, isolated in mental institutions or in cardboard boxes on the streets. The brain not only gives us a map of the body and the world, it also constructs a map of the social world. We do not have direct access to the physical world or to the mental world. We have access to these worlds as our brains expect them to be. When a discrepancy between prediction and reality arises, the brain adjusts its maps, most of the time. Our nervous systems allow us and others to manipulate the predictions and expectations of the brain. So, for instance, if I enter a room with the lights turned off and have an inkling that someone else is in the room with me, I will most likely interpret or misinterpret every sound or imagined sound to be that of someone in the room. I can use other techniques such as intensive music, photic drive, hyperventilation, hyperkinetics, hypokinetics, piercing and cutting, or just plain fasting for very long periods, which will lead to strange and extraordinary experiences and mental states. Dreams and emotional excitability can do the same thing. If you combine these techniques with a self-deceptive and superstitious brain, you will have all the ingredients necessary for a religious brain. All religious experts and leaders know about these things, consciously or not. There are very old religious traditions using such techniques, like shamanic and healing rituals. By a self-deceptive brain, I mean our proneness to illusion, confabulation, and credulity. We can be easy victims of sleight of hand, swindlers, and miracle makers. But we can also actively confabulate, make things up, and deliberately deny the obvious. Neuropsychologist Cordelia Fine describes the research on this subject in her book, A Mind of Its Own: How Your Brain Distorts and Deceives, 2006. Psychologist Dan Ariely has also written a number of best-selling books on the subject, such as The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves, 2012. These are books worth reading if you are curious about human psychology. They carry, however, deeply disturbing insights into what we are really doing when we think we are doing something else. The power of auto-suggestion is simply astounding. My use of the word superstition is problematic because it is generally a negative term that you apply to people whom you don't like. One could use the term supersense instead, as suggested by cognitive psychologist Bruce M. Hood in his book, Supersense: Why We Believe in the Unbelievable, 2009. He argues that humans are naturally inclined toward supernatural beliefs, even highly intelligent people. He asks, why are humans so willing to entertain the possibility of the supernatural? His answer is, most people believe because they think they have experienced supernatural events personally, or they have heard reliable testimony about the supernatural from those they trust. I would argue that we interpret our experiences and other people's reports within a supernatural framework because that framework is one that is intuitively appealing. It resonates with the way we think the world operates, with all manner of hidden structures and mechanisms. This supersense is a conglomeration of a constantly predicting, self-deceptive, highly social and conformity-biased brain in creatures prone to storytelling, gossip, and lies. Our narrative structures and themes follow suit. Add sacred values and emotions to this cocktail, and you have the kinds of minds we are looking for. As I mentioned earlier, we do not need language in order to communicate. Perhaps Homo erectus did have a kind of proto-language. At any rate, they could easily have had the same kinds of mental features as described here, perhaps not as well developed, but something like them. In fact, the psychological features I have mentioned probably came with these creatures, or even much earlier. Since we are dealing with creatures that spread outside Africa with new tools, a new social system, and the ability to adjust to varying climates and situations, they must have been intelligent and aware of their basic needs, goals, and common intentions. They must have thought about things and causes and happenstances. If they also had a super sense, here is my list of proto-religious behavior. 1. It would reflect the social group, centered near the fire, with implied gender-related domains, social status, and control. 2. It would also be concerned with social events such as life transition events, sexuality and female biological cycles, and fertility. 3. It would be concerned with death and the dead, as well as misfortune and evil. 4. It would reflect symbolic thought by signs and omens, and a sense of forces behind plants, food, medicinal, animals, game, fish, and natural phenomena, storms, drought, floods, eruptions, earthquakes. 5. It would involve magical thinking, sympathetic and contagious. 6. It would involve rituals, dance, music, and/or song, and various techniques to manipulate both body and mind. 7. It would involve experiences such as altered states of consciousness, dreams, fasting and hunger, psychopharmaca, self-inflicted pain, and so on. 8. It would be concerned with expressing group feelings, values, traditions, such as tool-making, and narratives, pre-linguistic, mimetic. The human story does not end here, of course, but this story does. What follows on the evolutionary scene are the Neanderthals, the anatomically modern humans, Homo sapiens, and the behaviorally modern humans, Homo sapiens sapiens. The story is extremely complicated, and the fanfare triumphalism usually connected with the appearance of Homo sapiens is less evident today. It seems that a lot of the creativity that we had associated with the appearance of anatomically modern humans some 200,000 years ago was already around in other species. So the sobering tale is the Darwinian one of slowly accumulated changes. Big brains were not enough. Big brains helped the hominins to adapt to larger and more diverse social networks, but other things had to fall into place before we find modern behavior. Language, for example, beyond 2 or 3 word sentences, had to emerge. The systematic use of external memory storage systems, first in symbolic media, later in writing, had to be developed. Truly modern behavior seems to have emerged about 50,000 years ago. But we find evidence of religious symbolism, burial rites and symbolic objects, ochre, shell beads, geometric engravings, long before. One of my favorites is the recently discovered site of Rhino Cave in the Tsodilo Hills of Botswana, excavated by archaeologist Sheila Coulson. In the cave, there is a huge quartzite outcrop with hundreds of cupules carved into it, so that it looks like a giant python. Furthermore, at the foot of the outcrop is a deep shaft filled with beautiful arrow and spear points, carefully produced from non-local stones, and then burned and smashed along with the whole stones that were used to produce the points. These materials were, without doubt, ritual offerings to the snake-like creature in the cave. A conservative estimate of its age is 80,000 years, but there is reason to believe that it is 100,000 years old. Coulson has described and analyzed this fascinating site in her 2011 article in Paleoanthropology, Ritualized Behavior in the Middle Stone Age, Evidence from Rhino Cave, Tsodilo Hills, Botswana. The point is that the history and evolution of proto-religious behavior is ancient. It emerged out of several million years of hominin existence, and probably even before them, with the appearance of symbolic competence. Our brains emerged together with, and not in addition to, culture. Culture drove the evolution of our brain in particular ways. This move cost us vital physiological changes and eventually led to modern human beings. It was a slow process, but an exciting one. and so is the story of our emergence. My conclusion and hypothesis is this. We are intelligent apes that are highly emotional, easily spooked, very superstitious, extremely sensitive to social norms and virtual realities, and equipped with nervous systems that are vulnerable to influence from conspecifics and their symbolic worlds. We and our brains are constantly predicting and constantly dwelling on the future in our attempts to navigate social and natural environments. Our brains fill in quite a bit, but our cultures are also in our brains and around them, filling in many more things.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.